Good evening and welcome to tonight's program, Chinese Medicine and Managing Diabetes with Dr. John Neeters. I'm Cynthia Miyashta, your program coordinator for today's program. Dr. Neeters teaches at four Bay Area acupuncture colleges, and he hosts the Balancing Point call-in radio show on KEST 1450 AM, Fridays at 7 AM. His goal with these activities is to educate about the practical applications and relevancy of traditional Chinese medicine today. Dr. Neeters works with many acupuncturists to deepen their understanding and the practical clinical applications of Chinese medical theory, advanced herbal formulation, herb-drug interactions, and how to integrate Chinese medicine with Western medicine. Dr. Neeters is a professor of advanced Chinese medical theory. He's certified by the National Board of Acupuncture Orthopedics and also certified by Xinhua Hospital in China in Integrative Diabetes Protocol. In his sixth appearance at the club tonight, Dr. Neeters will share his experience in treating diabetes, drawing on the tools from five branches of traditional Chinese medicine with technological advances of Western medicine to control diabetes or to reduce the risk of becoming diabetic. Would you please join me in welcoming Dr. John Neeters?
I want to thank you for coming out to the new location. This is my first time here. This is my sixth time doing talks for the Commonwealth Club, which, by the way, are my favorite talks. I talk all the time, from morning to night, usually. But most of the audiences that I speak to are, I'm going to say, more specialized. They're students, or they're doctors, or they're nurses, or they're people involved in some particular activity. And the Commonwealth Club, I love speaking at because of the tremendous variety of interests. There are people out here, I'm sure, who have no idea about Chinese medicine at all, and you're just curious. Some of you may be very, very skilled and versed. You might be Chinese medical doctors. I don't know. But so we get a very, very widely, a wide group of interests. So that makes it really fun, particularly in the question stage at the end. Now, one of the problems that I've had in speaking here is I tend to do really tight presentations. This is the first time I've ever done a presentation here without a visual. Now, the visuals are really nice because they're pretty and they get you involved, but I always try to put too much in, and then I don't have enough time for questions. So this is going to be a pretty short presentation, and I'm going to leave most of the time for your questions because that's really how I like to work anyway. So I'm just going to give you a little background on how Chinese medicine is used in China today and how it's used in much of the world. And when I say much of the world, I'm sure most of you realize that the real overarching kind of governing medical association in the world is the World Health Organization. Well, on October 1st of this year, we had the horrible pleasure of converting to a new coding system. We were on what was called the ICD-9 system for decades, and we just switched to a brand new code system, which has like five times more codes. But for the first time in history, the World Health Organization has caused 800 codes that are only for Chinese medicine to go into the international coding system. So that's a very significant thing because Oriental medicine, sometimes called Chinese medicine, sometimes called East Asian medicine, is practiced by a very, very large part of the world population, very, very successfully. So anyway, I want to thank you for having me here. I have made a commitment to do a minimum. I belong to a group called Foundation for Wellness Professionals. And part of my agreement is that I do at least one educational talk a week. I try to end up with two or three, but you're helping me reach my goal, so thanks. And I do talks, community service, on about 40 different subjects. And if you're interested for a club or something you might be involved in, there's some information in the back. So what I'm going to talk about is an overview of diabetes care in the U.S. and in China. And mostly what I'm going to look at are the differences and similarities and how diabetes care has been done in China. I had the great pleasure in my doctoral program to work with a gentleman named Jack Ma. And Jack was a Western-educated eye surgeon, but he was in charge of the diabetes, the change in the diabetes protocols in China that happened in the mid to late 2000s, around 2008 it went into effect. And so Jack oversaw this bringing together of medical experts from all fields of medicine in China because China, like the rest of the world, has a horrible diabetes epidemic. And this is new in China. We've had one here for quite a while, but India and China lead the world in the number of diabetes cases. And in a few minutes, I'm going to tell you why that's happening over there, why they're having so much diabetes. So the Chinese government, being very frugal, very different than the U.S. government, said we've got to stop this, and we have to do it inexpensively. Because in China, so in healthcare systems in the U.S. and in most countries of the world, unfortunately, there are many people, rural places like in China, the mining districts, et cetera, here the Appalachians, where nobody gets good medical care. Okay, that's just kind of an unfortunate fact. However, if you look at professional medical care across continents, across cultures, across countries, you'll see that the Chinese medical system is superior to the U.S. medical system as agreed upon by dozens of organizations. That's interesting, but what's fascinating to me is that they do it at 5% of the cost that medical care costs in the United States. And I'm going to go through, if you're interested at the end, the reasons for that, which are astonishingly simple. But we just don't do it here. And so they brought together, and here's, you can tell from right from the beginning, when they started looking at diabetes and changing their protocols, they did something that would never happen in the U.S. They left out two groups. They left out insurance companies, and they left out pharmaceutical companies. Now, in the U.S., when they're changing policy, guess who have the two most prominent seats at the table? The pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry. They don't even get to participate in China, period. Not that they don't use pharmaceuticals, but they say pharmaceutical companies should not be making medical policy, right? Who they did have, they had nutritionists, exercise physiologists, men's health specialists, women's health specialists, acupuncturists, herbalists, pharmacologists, medical doctors, eye specialists, kidney specialists, et cetera. And they said, okay, tell us what works. What do you do? Herbal doctors, what do you do that works? Bring us your cases, all right? And so they took that body of information and completely restructured their diabetes protocols with phenomenal success. Now, I can't duplicate everything that they do in China. And there are a couple things I'm going to talk about that are quite amazing that I'm trying to duplicate, but they're very difficult. So tonight, I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about what are the real causes of diabetes, how does traditional Chinese medicine treat diabetes, and how can you individually and we as a group prevent and treat and cure diabetes. Because I'll tell you the one fundamental problem with diabetes care in the United States, and there are many, but number one, anybody know what it is? Nobody expects you to get better. If you look at anything about diabetes, the term that they use is manage your diabetes. It doesn't say cure your diabetes. In China, they say manage your diabetes until it's cured. That's what I say. Manage your diabetes until you're no longer diabetic. And the stunning thing is, if you take that attitude, if your physician, your doctor, your healthcare provider takes that attitude, reversing diabetes is a relatively quick process. But if you don't think that's possible, and if you don't communicate to your patients that that's possible, but we have a team here, I can't get up and do the sit-ups for you in the morning. You got to do those, right? I can't push that donut back. Right? You can bring it to me, all right? And I'll eat it, but I'll help you that way, right? But It's a team. It's a team approach. And that is not the approach that is generally done in the United States. In China, it is completely and absolutely expected. We're a team. In fact, in China, this is the most startling thing. I was over there doing the protocol, and on Friday, they said, okay, come in. We're not going to do any classes. It's Diabetes Day. It's like, what? Just come. It's Diabetes Day. So we're sitting there watching this happen. And so what happens on Diabetes Day is that all the diabetics from that particular hospital, and I was in the hospital that specialized in this program, every diabetic in that hospital is expected to show up on Diabetes Day once a month. They come in. As they walk in, someone does a blood draw. They get weighed. Then they sit down and they watch a presentation by an exercise physiologist or a dance teacher or somebody who's teaching them a new exercise. Line dancing is huge over there, right? It is. It's crazy. You get out in the parks and you see everybody line dancing. But something to get their bodies moving. And they will get people up and teach them. Then a nutritionist comes in and talks to them about seasonal eating and what they should be eating at that time of year to control and cure their diabetes, okay? Now, then those, and there might be another presentation by someone else, there could be any number, but those are cores. Then there's a row of doctors and healthcare professionals, and each patient, they would take them by the row, they would start at one end, and they would each go down the line, and they would get their eyes checked, they would have their labs read. If it were men, they'd talk about rectal dysfunction. They'd have their feet checked, and they go right down the line of medical doctors, acupuncturists, herbalists, and nutritionists. This happens every month. So what does that do? You know why Weight Watchers works when it does? Cohort. There's a cohort. You get together with like-minded people, online now a lot of it, but in person's even better. So you get 100 people in this room. What are they going to do? Hey, Sally, when do you want to go exercise? You know, how are you doing with that new diet, right? So you get this huge cohort of people that are moving forward. More importantly, well, that's not more importantly, but equally as important is that blood test. They're monitoring these patients at least monthly so that they can make tiny changes as changes need to be made. So for herbal formulas, for example, I have about 50 base formulas that can be used to treat diabetes. But each one of them will be more effective at different stages in the diabetes lifestyle or the diabetes progression. And some are better in women, some are better in men, some are better depending on what the core of the diabetes is. Okay? And one of the, again, main differences, so I said in the U.S., they don't expect to cure diabetes. Unfortunately, that's actually the case with almost all chronic disease in the U.S., right? If they give you a drug for high blood pressure, what happens when you go off of it? Your blood pressure goes up. Did they cure the blood pressure? No. There's the branch, we call the root and the branch. The branch of diabetes could be high blood sugars. In fact, diabetes is defined as a blood sugar of 126 or over. Pre-diabetes around 100 to 125. So it's a number. Diabetes isn't a disease. I mean, fortunately, it has a code for a disease, but you can't actually treat diabetes by lowering the blood sugar because the blood sugar is a symptom of the underlying problem. The high blood pressure is a symptom of the underlying problem. The lowering of the good cholesterol, the HDL, particularly the HDL2, is not a disease, it is a symptom. The increase of LDL, the so-called bad cholesterol, is a symptom. The weight gain is a symptom. And if you give a drug, which is what happens, to lower the blood pressure, which, by the way, most blood pressure-lowering drugs increase diabetes risk significantly. If you give a drug for the diabetes, that causes other problems. And so as you go around trying to treat all of these symptoms, which we call the branch, it actually makes the overall condition worse. So you have to treat the root if you're going to treat diabetes. Now, this is not a new idea. This goes back 2,000 years, 2,200 years, to a book called the Huangdi Nei Jing. and even more profoundly elucidated in a book by my favorite author, a fellow named Lee Dong-yen. In 1250, roughly, he wrote a book called The Treatise of the Spleen and Stomach. In that book, he put forward a theory called yin fire theory. And he talked about the engenderment of these problems, the creation from lifestyle of these problems. And what yin fire was is a direct description of what we now call metabolic syndrome X, with all of those components and all caused by inflammation. Medical experts have known for decades that if you give patients high doses of salicylates, aspirin is a salicylate, it lowers their blood sugar. If you give them other anti-inflammatories, it lowers their blood sugar. You can give antibiotics and lower people's blood sugar. What does that tell you? It's inflammation. Inflammation is at the core of all of this, just as it's at the core of cancer and heart disease and most of the chronic illnesses we face. But most physicians treating diabetes are not treating the underlying root. They're treating all of the branches. So Li Dong-yen in 1250 described really clear-cut ways of treating diabetes, so I didn't have to make it up. Now, I have the advantage of being able to use his work in herbalism and acupuncture and lifestyle and use Western medical testing. To me, that's the best of both worlds, because there are some great medical tests that unfortunately are not done often enough for diabetes. One of the problems in diabetes diagnosis, particularly in the United States, is, and you've all had this test, I'm sure, you've had a fasting glucose test, okay? And your doctor said, oh, it's really bad, or oh, look at this, you're great. Well, you know the fasting glucose test? The American Diabetes Association and several of the other major medical controllers in this country, the powers that be, 7-8 years ago, I'm guessing, a memo went out to medical practices and doctors saying, do not ever use a fasting glucose as a screening test for diabetes. It's a horrible test. In fact, you can have diabetes for 10 years or more before your fasting glucose shows that you have diabetes. The other interesting fact is that we also know that most of the damage done from diabetes is done in the first 10 years. And so here's the problem with that test. So with a fasting glucose, you're supposed to fast for 12 hours, right? You don't eat. And then they test your blood sugar. It's a spot check. Well, let's say you eat a meal that should, you know, your blood sugars go up. And let's say they should come back to normal in an hour. Well, in the first year, you're having insulin resistance and you're having the leptin resistance and the problems that lead to diabetes. Maybe it's elevated for 2 hours. The next year, maybe it's elevated for 3 hours. Next year, it's elevated for 4 and 5 and 6. So you could go all the way until it's elevated for 12 hours, but during that entire 10-year period, you are experiencing the inflammatory damage from the high blood sugars and the high inflammation. So that's why it's a horrible test. A hemoglobin A1C, which is a very inexpensive test and should be the screening test, is often used the opposite. Once they determine you have diabetes, then they do a hemoglobin A1C. Really, really faulty thinking. They would never do that in China because they know they have to catch that diabetes before your blood sugar gets to 126. By then, you've had 10 years of damage already, right? And 10 years of damage not just from the inflammation, but that inflammation affects your brain. Hypothalamus, it affects a hormone called leptin. Leptin is a fascinating hormone. Leptin has lots of jobs, but the two major ones are A, it tells you you've had enough to eat, right? It gives a signal that, oh, I've had enough. You know, that was a satisfying meal. Secondly, it tells your body that it's safe to burn fat. So if the leptin cycle gets interrupted, you don't know when to stop eating and your body won't burn fat. In fact, it's one of the major things that has to be done in truly effective weight loss programs and in diabetes care is to balance the leptin as well as the insulin and the other hormones. Let's get get to a little prevention. So is someone going to give me times? Okay, yeah. Just, you know, I can go on forever. I'm on page two of my notes. So, and again, going back to the lead up to diabetes and the fact that diabetes truly isn't a disease. It has a disease code, and that's great. But if you treat it as a standalone disease, you're going to have great suffering. What goes along with that, it's the number one cause of fatty liver disease. I mean, alcoholism's up there. But I'm seeing statistics now ranging, depending on who you listen to, that between 12 and 25% of adolescents are now experiencing fatty liver disease. Now, that's something, you know, traditionally the only people that got fatty liver disease, or almost the only people, were alcoholics. And these kids are getting fatty liver disease at 15, 16 years old at alarming rates. Polycystic ovarian syndrome, which is debilitating for women, particularly for fertility, but for many other reasons, that rate is skyrocketing also. And so they're all hand in hand with the diabetes in epidemic because they're all caused by the same problems. So let's talk about the four pills. Well, by the way, it's also the number one cause of blindness, the number one cause of kidney dialysis, major cause of liver cancer, major cause of pancreatic cancer. So it's a nasty, nasty grouping of things. Infertility, et cetera. I want to talk about the fact that when we're looking at diabetes, oh, so I mentioned my hero, Li Dongyan. And what Li Dongyan did, so in China, from the time of this, there was a great classic of herbalism written in about 200 AD. And nothing new happened in China until about the 1100s. Because China, at that point, was Confucian. And under Confucianism, everything has its place, and you do not question its place. Here's grandpa, who's in charge, and then father, and mother's over here, and the older daughter, and the older son. Everything in the world has a place. So herbalists couldn't question this book. But then, in the Jin Yuan era, we saw this change to Neo-Confucianism. And now you still had to say grandpa was the best, but maybe I don't really like eating liver, you know, or whatever it is. You could actually start to question. And so I saw this whole new group of physicians, these Jin Yuan physicians, and they started to question the cause of disease. And they said, yes, when this great book, the Shang Hanlun, was written in 200 AD, the cause of illness was external. It was externally contracted. These people didn't have heat. They didn't have running water. They were getting infections. They were getting colds, etc. Most of their illness was externally engendered, and then it moved into the body. But Li Dongyan said, that's no longer the case. Now, almost, he said, all of the illness that I treat, he, Li Dongyan, is internally engendered. Now, this is a big shift. This could never have happened under Confucianism. And he said, what's happening now is that the lifestyle of the people has changed. Now, this is back in 1250, okay? And he was saying people are eating badly. By the way, he said they're eating too much wheat, just in case you want to know, right? He said they're eating badly. They're eating too many dumplings and starchy foods. I tell them to stop eating rice, but they don't listen to me. But the biggest thing that happened around that time is they learned how to distill alcohol. So that was a biggie. In fact, he, before he died, said, one thing I'm sorry about is I created this brilliant formula for hangovers. And now everybody takes my hangovers and goes out and gets drunk, right? So, but it's a brilliant formula, by the way, if you ever want to know. But he said it's all lifestyle. And he looked at that point on the four pillars that we see now as the seat upon which diabetes rests. One, we all know, it's diet. In Li Dongyan's time, the average sugar consumption was maybe a half a pound a year, if you were wealthy. Now it's up to about 160 to 180 pounds a year. So our pancreas was never designed for that, you know, 350 times more sugar that we're now putting into it. By the way, the body was not designed to be able to process large amounts of fructose or high fructose corn syrup. We were designed to do minuscule amounts. The metabolic processes to digest other sugars are very different from fructose because people didn't eat much fructose, right? You had a pear, you had an apple, you had some fruit. But with the advent of the ability to make alcohol, spirits, then you saw a huge increase in fructose ingestion. And then with the advent, I'm sure you've all seen Robert Lustig's work, brilliant work on fructose. If you haven't, you've got to read his book. You've got to see, he's got great videos, where he goes through how high fructose corn syrup became the mainstay. It was because of the poverty in the 60s, and they were trying to find a cheap way to get calories into people. Unfortunately, it kills people because the body can't process the amount of high fructose corn syrup that we're putting into it. And you look at those 56-ounce big gulps, you're seeing a kid that will develop fatty liver disease, which is often fatal. So this is a real problem. So pillar number one, diet. Pillar number two, exercise. We know that. However, what most people don't realize is that the exercise that you need to do to help prevent diabetes is not sufficient to get you out of diabetes, okay? It won't do it, trust me. Walking is great. It will lower every risk factor you have. It will not reverse diabetes. Number three and four are the ones that the doctor usually doesn't talk to their patients about. Number three is quality of sleep. If you look at studies on people with sleep apnea, their rates of diabetes are astronomically higher than people that sleep well. Anyone who sleeps less than 6.5 hours uninterrupted has about a 3 times more likely rate of developing diabetes in the following year. That's a big number. That's worse than eating a few Krispy Kreme donuts, okay? You'd be better off getting your sleep handled. And number four is stress. I have stress inventories in my office. I see a lot of therapists. They need a lot of acupuncture, a lot of psychologists. And so I talk to them about stress inventories, and say they'll bring theirs in, their favorites. And so they have a numbering system about life stressors, moving to a new home, losing a loved one, having a baby, getting married, getting divorced. And when I question my diabetics, and anything over, depends on the test, but the one I'm thinking about, anything over 150 is high stress. Most of them are at 600 or 700. And that level of stress will actually do more to create diabetes than the diet and exercise piece. But nobody talks about it. So what do you do? How are we doing on time? Okay, hey, look at this. Woo! So in China, as I said, they bring everybody in and they work on the four pillars every month. Every doctor's visit, they work on the four pillars. So if you have diabetes or pre-diabetes, what I would highly recommend is taking it very seriously and work on those four pillars. What they do in China is they detect early, they get treatment early, they create a cohort. And how they keep the costs so low is they don't take insurance, they don't have pharmaceutical company intervention, and they don't have any bias about the modalities. They do everything across the board that works, and they treat all four legs of the problem. So for you, if you're pre-diabetic, or let's say you're not even pre-diabetic, you need to move. I mean, there's just no doubt about it that 30 to 40 minutes a day on average of walking or some other exercise is going to keep your heart much healthier. It's going to keep everything much healthier. However, once you move into pre-diabetes and diabetes, that's not enough. What I most commonly recommend for my patients is to work with a trainer to make sure we're, and with their medical doctor, to make sure we're finding an accurate maximum heart rate. That's important. And then having them do interval training. In interval training, you're stressing the body differently. Long cardiovascular is the worst you can do. I'm not putting walking in that category, but you know, getting on your treadmill and going for 45 minutes, because you're telling the body. So what happens if you take a 1 pound weight and you lift it 100 times to the muscle? Nothing happens, because the muscle says, we're doing fine. We can do this all week, so we don't need to do anything. But if you took 30 pounds, 40 pounds, as much as you could do, and you did it three times, you'd start to see an increase in muscle mass. The body is trying to put you in a position where you can succeed, let's say. And with blood sugars, you really have to stress that system. You can only do it twice a week for most people, but you need to do about 20 minutes of interval exercise. And again, you have to see your medical doctor or someone else that can monitor you before you start this. And so what you would do, when I was playing football in high school, we'd run a 50-yard dash and walk back. That's interval training. So you run the 50-yard dash, you're totally out of breath, you can't even talk, you walk back. By the time you get back, you can turn around and run another 50-yard dash. Now, I don't do that anymore, but on your exercise bike or if you go to the gym, they'll have either a random hill or a training program where you can max out for 30 to 45 seconds and you're trying to hit a particular heart rate level and you want to get to the point where you can't really talk, and then you rest until you come down to a different heart rate number, which is near your resting heart rate, and you do that 5 to 6 times, and you only do it twice a week. And that completely, I've had people go from blood pressures of 220, that's almost death, on heavy medication, down to 150, and had cut their medication in half to get at 150. They had to cut it because they were going too low. I've had them go from blood sugars in the 200 range fasting down to around 100 in a few weeks just by doing these simple, simple things. It's really, the body can respond very quickly. Now, the longer you've been diabetic, the longer it takes to fix it. So that's two. The third is you have to make sure that you're sleeping well. Now, one of the cool things, you know, I'm 64 and I'm getting dragged kicking and screaming into the technological revolution, but there are a lot of things I like, and I love smartphones because the smartphones almost all have apps that you can very inexpensively put on. Some of them will actually read pulse oxes, but most of them will at least give you a reading on how well you're sleeping. Now, ideally, best would be go to a sleep center and get checked. But you need to do something to make sure that you're sleeping well. If you have apnea, so if you stop breathing at all and your husband or wife elbows you and says, hey, what's going on? You have to fix that. That will kill you very quickly. It's one of the worst problems that we have medically. It's very easy to fix, typically, and that's more of, we have treatments with acupuncture that are very effective. There's a woman in Brazil that published a study on a Flavia Ferrae, astonishing, and we get what are called AHIs, which are events, from 30 down under 5 very often. However, it's going to cost you less if you go get a CPAP machine, right? Because then your insurance will cover it, and you do that. But you've got to get the sleep handled. And number 4 is the hardest. It's the stress. Just assume that you are overstressed because you live in the United States, all right? We are crazy people here. So you have to find some way to monitor and regulate your stress. So for some people, that's meditation. Some people go crazy if you tell them to meditate. You can get binaural beat CDs where they play a different frequency in each ear, and that meditates you. You don't have a choice. You just lay there, and the brain waves will adjust to it, and it'll put you in a meditative state. So there are many, many ways that you can go about the de-stressing piece of your life, affirmations, your religion. There are many, many ways, but that's the fourth pillar that usually gets overlooked. Okay, that doesn't mean you can eat all those Krispy Kreme donuts. By the way, you know where this epidemic's coming from? And this was one of my teachers in China, and this woman, top diabetes educator in China, and she did 100 plus slides about diabetes. And every single slide, every one of them, only talked about Chinese medicine. She didn't mention a single neurohormone, a single neurotransmitter, nothing. But her very last slide, diabetes is an illness that happens or is caused by stress and poor eating habits in adolescence. She said it's an adrenal fatigue problem. And every morning, and I don't have time to talk about adrenals and thyroids and how that fits into this, but every morning when I drive to my office, I drive by Pete's and Starbucks. They're on opposite corners, and invariably I'll see 3 or 4 young women walking out with their mocha frappuccinos, right, cruising down the street, not talking to each other, talking on their cell phones. There is more sugar in that drink than in 10 Krispy Kreme glazed donuts. And the caffeine is hyper-stimulating their adrenal glands. They're secreting massive amounts of adrenaline and cortisol primarily, which is, cortisol is one of the worst things for the pancreas and for that entire system. So these, they're my future patients, unfortunately. And horribly, they're showing up younger and younger and younger. So I think that's all I want to say. I'm sure I'll talk for another half hour, but I'm going to let you ask questions. Yes. Here she got. She's ready for you.
Thank you very much. Just a lot to cover in a very short time. I'm a Kaiser patient. Uh-huh. Kaiser reports itself as the number one system in the country for preventive medicine, and yet they use the glucose fasting test as a screening device. Why is that? Can you help me understand?
What's your name?
My name is Dee.
Dee, my wife is cringing in the back of the room because she's afraid I'm going to go off on a rant here, okay? Now, I love Kaiser. Just saying. I was born in a Kaiser hospital. My dad worked for Kaiser. It's all good. I think Kaiser gives great care in many ways. I had a patient who had Hashimoto's thyroiditis, juvenile onset diabetes, and polycystic ovaries. This woman could not get pregnant, right? Condom broke, she got pregnant. No kidding. Kaiser gave her the best care I have ever seen a woman in that condition get. And the care that the infant got in neonatal ICU, brilliant, amazing. So my experience with Kaiser is when they agree that there's something wrong with you, they have some of the best care in the world. I, however, do not agree that they are good with preventive health care. And I base that on my experience with hundreds and hundreds of Kaiser patients. I don't want to go into too much detail, but what my experience of Kaiser is that they grossly undertest. I belong to a professional co-op service. And so if you were to come in and get lab tests, I would get you a CBC, a Chem-14, a urinalysis, 3 thyroid tests, about 3 pages of information. That costs $69. I mean, really, it's not a bank breaker. Kaiser typically runs 4 tests. Unless they've agreed there's something wrong with you, and then they run this beautiful battery of tests. It's amazing. But to get there is hard. And so I've had so many patients come in stage 3 kidney failure that were never told. Now, that's not too bad. That's not as bad as it sounds. Hypothyroid. Because, you see, one of the things that people don't realize generally is that labs, for the most part, make up their own values, their own ranges. Now, some of them are set. High blood pressure ranges are set. Glucose ranges are set. Those are specifically numbers. But, for example, with thyroid, if you're looking at thyroid-stimulating hormone, which is the most common test done to screen for thyroid disorders. Now, there are actually 22 identifiable types of hypothyroid, and that only catches 2 of them, but that's still the most common test done. If you go to Kaiser, the last time I looked, they say you're normal up to 5.5. LabCorp says you're normal up to 4.5. Stanford Lab says you're normal up to 4, and the American Council of Endocrinology says once you're over 3, you're hypothyroid. Well, that's a big range. So Kaiser says you can have twice as much of this thyroid-stimulating hormone, and we're still going to call you normal. And I belong to fertility boards, and for fertility, you've got to get a female patient down in the low 2s to have a realistic chance of them getting pregnant, okay, if there are other complications. So, again, you've got these huge ranges involved, right? And so that's part of it, right? So I love Kaiser. I think they underdiagnose. No, I'm sure they're going to, I mean, they. Who am I, right? Yeah.
Okay. I heard that.
Oh, he's got the mic. Yeah. Sorry. We're going to let her handle this.
So I have 2 quick questions.
Okay.
One is, I think you mentioned that the root cause of all disease, including diabetes, is inflammation.
Not all, okay. But most chronic illness.
Okay. So what's the best way to reduce that inflammation? And the second question is on stress. Is there a way for me to tell what my stress level is on my own?
Yes. There's a very so stress will often show up. By the time you get to 40, at least, it will often show up as an insufficiency in adrenal function. Now, unfortunately, I think that's overused, but on the other hand, it's undertreated, right, this whole adrenal piece. And there are two very simple tests that can be done in the doctor's office. One is a test called Ragland's test, which is often done for orthostatic hypotension. So if you stand up and get dizzy because your blood pressure drops. But Ragland's is actually also a test for adrenal sufficiency. So when you go from lying down to standing up, you're going vertical. You need more pressure to get the blood up into your brain. With adrenal insufficiency, generally after long-term stress and fatigue, the body does not secrete enough. There are about 50 to 60 hormones that the adrenals are releasing that control massive amounts of what happens in our body. And one of those hormones tells the blood pressure to go up. So when you go from lying to standing, that pressure should go up 10 points. If it goes down, you know you have adrenal insufficiency. And it could be dangerous if you already have low blood pressure and then it goes down further, then that could be a medical emergency. And that happens to many older people who are over-medicated. They get their blood pressures too low, then they have orthostatic hypotension and they pass out and hit their head. This is not uncommon at all. That test is an indicator in terms of physiological stress in the body. A simple stress inventory is actually not a bad thing to sit down with. You can find them online and just go, yeah, okay, I hate my boss. You know, I don't get enough sleep. And you just give yourself a numerical score. And that's actually not a bad place to start, right? And then if you go to a therapist, you can do tons of other testing. Or if you come to me, I feel your pulses. Or look at your tongue. I see your tongue? No. And it's very clear. You cannot miss it with a tongue and pulse diagnosis.
And the inflammation, how to reduce inflammation?
There are many ways to reduce inflammation. Number one is to stop doing the things that are creating the inflammation. Number two, and trust me, I can talk for days on this one, so I'm going to really squeeze it down. There are genetic components, right? Some people are more susceptible to certain things. There is a way that the immune system can get turned on inaccurately. They're in really gross. God, I hope there are nobody that specializes in this. There are two major parts of the immune system, a Th1 and a Th2. And each of those can get elevated or hypofunctioning. And if it gets elevated on one side and hypofunctional on the other, then you'll start to see a higher incidence of certain diseases. Like if it's a Th1 elevation, you'll see more Crohn's disease, more rheumatoid arthritis, more autoimmune like conditions like that. If Th2, and again, this is very gross, Th2 is elevated, you'll start to see more asthma, more eczema, things like that, this is one of the reasons I think herbs are phenomenally safe in general, but this is why people should not self-medicate. Because there's many common herbs, ginseng, echinacea, licorice, which all elevate the Th1 system. So if you have a patient or a person with a little rheumatoid arthritis and it's not too bad, and they start to catch a cold and they take all those immune stimulants, huangqi, astragalus is probably the biggest one, it'll just put that part of their immune system into hyperdrive and can make them much worse. And believe me, I see a lot of patients that come in where that hasn't been taken into consideration. So diet, if there's an autoimmune problem, then you'd want to treat that. You'd want to see which part of the immune system is hyper or hypofunctioning. Do that. Diet, the single biggest thing, there are three things that you can't go wrong with. You guys ready? This is the only takeaway from tonight. There are three things that are incredibly unlikely to be problematic and help everybody, and you probably heard of all of them, and you should be doing them. Fish oil or some other form of eicosapentaenoic acid. It could be krill, it could be fish, it could be cod liver, which has some benefits. Those are anti-inflammatory. Our diets were typically, there's omega-6s and omega-3s. You've all heard of omega-3s, okay? Well, historically, even 100 years ago, we were probably 2-to-1 omega-6s to omega-3s. Omega-3 is very anti-inflammatory. Omega-6 can be inflammatory. There are people where that ratio is 50 or 100 to 1 now, many people actually, because of their diets. And so controlling that, and one way to balance it is to get rid of the bad food, eat the good food. Another one is you got to eat organic. I mean, really, I know it's, people say it's a fad. There are over 82,000 chemicals that have been released into our environment that didn't exist 100 years ago. Only a quarter of those have ever been checked for safety. You don't want that in the food you eat. You really don't. And when studies are done, like at UC Davis, looking at organic fruits and vegetables versus non, they find oranges with no vitamin C in it. You go to a typical grocery store, they find tomatoes with no vitamin C in it. So they're so devoid of vitamins and minerals, it's like eating cardboard. So that's one way. If you're going to eat meat, it has to be grass-fed. Non-grass-fed meat is a horrific source of inflammation. Okay? The arachidonic acid is horrible. And I tell people, they say, well, it's too expensive. And I say, eat half as much. Right? You're going to win all the way around. Then meditation, sleep, all the things I said, because again, anything that's going to help diabetes is going to help inflammation in general. Now, beyond that, I could, like, there was one guy I had in here that I didn't get to named Tony who was really sick. I had him on 40 supplements. Typically, a patient might be on 2. Okay, so fish oil, vitamin D. Vitamin D turns on or off over 2,000 genes in the body. There's only a tiny percentage of the population of people with sarcoidosis, severe inflammatory diseases that might have a problem with vitamin D. So you need, the average person at this latitude needs 4,000 to 5,000 units a day to stay level. So just figure, that's an incredibly safe dose. The people who run the vitamin D council do 50 to 150,000 a day. I am not recommending that you do that. I am recommending you do 5. The area where we're seeing more breakthroughs in research around the human body and prevention of illness over the last 5 years is in probiotics. I used to do whole lectures before this got popular, I mean to students, to doctors, on the damages of leaky gut in our culture. It's horrific. I don't do them so much because lots of other people do now, but a good quality probiotic is really wonderful, unless you're eating a lot of soured foods or you're making your own pickles and kimchi and things like that. If you're not, you need probiotics. Those are the three. Do those three, and your odds get much better. That help? Okay, sir.
This will be short. I heard that holy basil will neutralize cortisol.
Holy basil is specifically a cortisol mediator. That is accurate, and it does lower inflammation. I don't have enough information on holy basil to recommend it in general. And the reason I say that, like, there are things like quercetin, one of my favorite antioxidants, resveratrol, one of my favorite antioxidants, those both trigger TH2 responses. So it's really, I try to be very, very selective and careful. In general, I think holy basil is probably gonna be a miracle thing. Oh, turmeric, which has gotten lots and lots of airplay, is a TH2 stimulant. So if you have asthma or eczema, I would cut out the turmeric. So holy basil, great. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for an exciting talk here. I have three very quick questions. The first one is, you've left the subject of hereditary causes behind. You didn't mention anything about inheriting diabetes. Are you implying that this is not the case? The second one is, again, coming back to inflammation, because inflammation is such a big word. You can fit an elephant's backside into the word inflammation.
Yeah. I love
so
it.
So I really don't know what you're implying. Are you talking about the cellular level, or are you talking about inflammation of a different type? And the third question is something you referred to right at the beginning of your talk, which I thought was quite interesting, and you skipped through it very quickly. When you were in China, you said at the clinics, they were talking to people with dietitians about what to eat seasonally. What is the implication of that? What do you mean by eating seasonally? Why
is that
important? Let me
start with number 3, and then I'll probably have to have you remind me of 2 and 1. Seasonal eating is a core concept in Chinese medicine, also in Ayurvedic medicine. The idea being that there are certain foods that have been available traditionally at certain times of the year, and people ate those and developed our genetics around eating those foods, right? our genetics were modified according to what we ate, okay? Where we lived, what was available. And when we look, and I did a whole, by the way, there's a whole Commonwealth Club talk on this. I don't know if it's still up, but I talked about only, but the whole thing was seasonal eating. And the idea being that at certain times of the year, there are different requirements, both internally and environmentally on your system. In the summer, you're getting tremendous amount of energy from the atmosphere. In the winter, you're an energy donor. And as we get older, it hit me about 4 years ago when I walked outside and I said, oh, I'm an energy donor. And I could feel it getting sucked out of my hands. It was weird. I used to talk about it, but I didn't experience, right? And so how and what you eat will vary. So for example, in spring, there's a lot of green available. Green is also, the green foods are extremely detoxifying, extremely. If people are doing a detox diet, it will often be centered around green foods. Again, we talk about cleansing the blood. I don't want to get into what that means, but it's very, very effective at lowering inflammation in the body from eating the heavy food that people had to eat during the winter because they had meat, they had root vegetables, which kept them very warm, but also put a lot of impurities into their system. Then in the summer, when it's very hot, you don't want to eat foods that are going to overheat you, right? You want things that are going to release energy to keep things flowing freely. So they would eat then, watermelon is the ideal food for summer on so many levels. But they would eat foods like that. And the classic, and then in fall you're going to yellow, orange, red, which are very high in antioxidants and are going to protect the lungs from the ravages of the fall. And then in the winter you're supposed to stay in your hut and eat your potatoes and root vegetables and whatever meat you have salted away. So that kind of idea. And the way I look at it, as an example, is I like my patients, if they're tea drinkers, to drink green tea in the spring. I like them to drink white tea during the summer because it's very cooling. I like them to drink an oolong as we're going into fall because they're very high antioxidant levels, and I like them then maybe to drink a black tea in the winter because those black teas, like Earl Grey, was made for London. It has bergamot, which is a spice that brings the heat to the internal part of the body, whereas like Mexican spices bring it to the outside. So those heavier spices that you'll see in Scandinavia, in cold parts of the world, were selected because they bring the heat internally. What was number two? Oh yeah, it's huge. I listen to stuff on this in my car, drives my family nuts. The bottom line is, when there is an immune response, there is inflammation. Inflammation is healing. You cannot have healing without inflammation. You shut off healing, you shut off inflammation, it doesn't heal. What I'm talking about then, when I use this as a general term, is when the body doesn't shut off the inflammation and it becomes chronic. And that's what I was talking about, like these TH1 and TH2 systems. Because what happens with that inflammation, there are chemical messengers, cytokines being sent out to recruit more white cells to come to the site. Well, if that isn't being turned off, and there are cells that specifically turn off that immune response, it goes crazy. And then you get this massive systemic inflammation. And that, in our culture, is made much worse because, again, the chemical, it's, you know, all the things that we're dealing with. You know what the death rate from standing next to an idling diesel truck, how much higher people that live in that environment is? I mean, it's astronomical. So we're breathing this stuff in all the time. They didn't have to deal with that 1,800 years ago. So I'm using inflammation in a very general term, unless I use it specifically, which I sometimes do. And number one, genetic. I think genetics, what we're seeing now, is so astonishing. So astonishing. When you look at epigenetics, the change in gene pools and an individual DNA in a human being, and they've proven that changes during your lifetime. And there are events, there is dietary stuff, there are many things that can actually change your DNA while you're alive. So, do I believe in genetics? Absolutely. If someone's Ashkenazi Jewish by heritage, I know that their chance of getting a list of diseases is much higher, because I have family on that side, of a dozen different diseases. So there is a genetic predisposition. People with a CY677 gene, which controls methylfolate, and if that's defective, they have a much greater chance of having a stroke, blood clots, and depression, right? But it doesn't mean it has to happen. In fact, in those cases, we have very specific things that can be done to help mediate it, right? So genetics is a piece. It's a kind of a direction. But not everybody who has those genetics that look exactly the same will catch the same diseases. Now, when you're dealing with the BRCA gene, that's a bad one, right? And that one's, you know, it's over in this area where it's almost always the case. But most genes, like, for example, vitamin D. The biggest and most significant factor in multiple sclerosis is vitamin D exposure or sunlight exposure or vitamin D intake of the mother while the child is in utero. That's the single biggest thing. Now, Fred Epperle came out in the 50s, late 40s, with his studies showing that the further from the equator a child live before the age of 15, the greater their chance of MS. So they thought, well, it's the kids. But they've now pretty conclusively proven that it's vitamin D levels in the mom that controls that. Children born of vegetarian mothers who do not take supplemental high-quality fats, DHA primarily, their children on average are 6 to 10 lower in IQ points. So is there a genetic component? Yeah. But take some fish oil and some vitamin D, and you get rid of a lot of it. So no, genetics. Genetics is huge.
Yes, my question is about sleeping.
Poking you with your elbow.
Taking naps during the day count towards your 6.5 or 7 hours?
Yes, but it's not perfect. Men that nap daily have about half the cardiovascular risk. Half. Taking a 15 to 20 minute nap a day lowers cardiovascular risk by half. So yes, take those naps and go get a sleep study and clean that out too. All right. Yes.
Thank you for doing this. So I've been taking the Huanglin for diabetes, prescribed by a professor in Hong Kong University. And I wonder if there's a long-term effect that's...
It depends on who you ask. If you ask an MD, you'll get one answer. If you ask a naturopath, you'll get a different answer. And if you ask me, yes, there is a long-term deleterious effect also. It absolutely is one of the best things to control blood sugar. Berberine, the primary alkaloid, it's amazing in the studies that we're seeing. And so you'll see naturopaths prescribe a lot of it. Doctors are now starting to prescribe it. In Chinese medicine, we consider it a little bit too cold to use all the time. So we will moderate it with some other things. And cold in Chinese medicine, again, we take a month. Right? But essentially, we're looking, antibiotics are the coldest substances you can take. And so what they're doing is destroying the flora and fauna in your gut. Huanglian is very powerfully antibiotic, and so taking it for too long at too high a dose without moderating it with some other herbs could cause, it's an antibiotic. It's going to kill bacteria also. So we like to keep the usage a little more moderate. Now, I do use it. In fact, I use Huanglian Su, which is the pharmaceutical grade of Huanglian, and I think that's a little less damaging in some ways, but I don't know. So I use it carefully. Exactly. And that's the thing with Chinese herbalism. You never give a single herb. And with naturopaths, they'll often give one herb, and that's bothersome to me when they do that. Whereas Chinese herbs are always... In the formula, you're doing things to control against any negative side effects.
Yes, sir. At the beginning of your talk, you mentioned about acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we'd like to know more about it. What is the difference between the acupuncture that's done in China and here? Is it recognized now in the state if you go to acupuncture, for example?
Acupuncture... People often ask me, how long have people been doing acupuncture? Well, there are books going back 2,200 years or so, but by that time the theory was really well developed. I mean, they had everything mapped out. If you go further back, you guys are probably, you're all a group that's interested in learning things. You probably all know Utsi the Iceman, the guy that they pulled out of the Alps a few years ago. Well, when they checked Utsi out, one guy, in fact, I saw this as an exhibit at the Smithsonian. It was great. One of the people said, hey, wait a minute. Those tattoos are on acupuncture points, and the lines are the acupuncture meridians. So they brought in a Chinese medical expert, and he said, oh, yeah, absolutely. That's a map of his meridian system, and this is where he's been getting punctured, and these are the conditions you should expect to find, and he had them. Now, that was 6,000 years ago in the Italian Alps. There's a figure called the Malta Woman that shows a mud figure of a woman giving birth, and the baby's crowning just at that moment, and it's a mud figure. But embedded at exactly the acupuncture points that you would treat a woman at that stage of delivery are precious gems. That's 10,000 years old. So we don't know how far back this stuff goes. What we do know is there was a very complete theoretical understanding by 2,200 years ago. Now, when I say understanding, there's a big misunderstanding. Chinese medicine is pre-scientific. It is not unscientific at all. There are now 23,000 studies on PubMed, studies of acupuncture. But I had a doctor, you know, say, well, if there was any evidence, I'd take a look at it. I'd say, 23,000 studies, you go read 1% and then come back and we'll talk, right? So there's massive information. Now, within acupuncture, there are dozens of some subsystems. I studied with one person who invented, actually, the scalp acupuncture system for dealing with neurological conditions and stroke. All he treats is the head. There's an ear acupuncture system that is very, very commonly used for addiction, and many addiction clinics throughout the country will just do ear acupuncture points. And there are many different systems. Japanese acupuncture, they use very, very tiny needles. Sometimes they don't even insert them. They just lay them on the body. You won't even know the doctor's there. In China, they tend to be much more aggressive. Bigger needles, more pain, right? In the U.S., my teachers said that isn't necessary, and I'm glad, because I don't like, my patients are much happier. So I use smaller needles, very light touch. People, you know, usually are asleep within 5 minutes of the treatment. And how it works, 23,000 studies. The problem that the Western medical profession has, and I've actually read this in Quack Watch, we know acupuncture can't work because every study shows that it works. How do you argue with that, right? Right? But we know, there's one of my teachers, a guy named Peng Li, who's down at UC Irvine, brilliant researcher. They brought him over from China just to do this research, and he's done dozens. It's L-I is the last name. First name is P-E-N-G. And they do functional MRIs and PET scans of the brain while they're needling the points. And they watch the changes in blood flow. So like with post-traumatic stress, which the Pentagon now uses acupuncture as a frontline treatment for PTSD, as they're flying the guys and gals from Afghanistan to Ramstein in Germany, they're doing acupuncture on them, on the plane coming over. So those wild and wacky new age guys at the Pentagon, right? So what we do know is it changes blood flow in the brain and blood flow throughout the body. It changes neurohormone levels and neurotransmitter levels, and it causes, for injuries, a localized release of a chemical called adenosine, which dramatically speeds up healing. Oh, yeah, it's huge. Huge, and it's what I warn every single patient about. There is a horrible side effect. You will want to come in every single day. If I saw patients for free, this is the truth. If I would see my patients for free, I'd have a line around the block every single day. People, particularly in not so much in China, but our stress levels are so high here, our anxiety levels are so high, when you shut that sympathetic nervous system off, even for 45 minutes. In fact, how you doing? It's one of my students. So when I teach practice management, I tell, you know, people get all freaked out. Well, how do I build my practice? I said, it's really easy. You videotape your stressed out patients walking in, and you videotape them floating out. So, sorry, can't help that. Yes.
Doctor, is it good, they recommended me to have artichoke?
Artichokes. Artichokes.
Diabetes.
You said artichoke?
Yes.
Yes. Artichokes are one of my favorite foods. Another problem we see here, I don't know if this is still the case. Someone I wish, if anybody knows, let me know. As of a few years ago, the number one surgery in the U.S., to have something removed at least, was gallbladder surgery. I finally had my first patient have her gallbladder removed out because she was totally noncompliant. Otherwise, I've never had a patient lose a gallbladder. It's so easy to save. And one of the key foods is artichokes. Another is radishes, and another is beets, because that combination makes the bile thinner and lets it flow easier, and you can get it out of the gallbladder easier. So it's really good for treating gallbladder conditions. Not as much directly for blood sugars, but if you do that, it's going to help, even with the diabetes. I hate kombucha. My wife is back there in the orange scarf. She loves kombucha. There are tons of health qualities. If you get it within a foot, I'll throw up. I can't stand this stuff.
Dr. Nieders, we've kind of run out of time. I did want to give you the chance, though, to tell us, have you cured anyone with diabetes?
I've never cured anybody of anything. I'm really clear about that. One, I say that for legal reasons. But two, the body, your body, and this universal intelligence do all of the healing, period. I am absolutely certain of that. I have never cured or healed a single person in my life. But I can help you get to that point. So in terms of reversing diabetes, we do it all the time. In fact, when I was in clinic, and it was a pretty big class, it was observation class, I would tell everybody in the first week, bring all your diabetic relatives, because in 4 months, when the class is over, they won't be diabetic anymore. And that was true almost every case. It takes about 4 months for early stage to reverse it. It's about 8 months if you're more severe. If someone's on insulin already, then that's a tough one. But until they get on insulin, expect to reverse it. I have some cards back there. Thank you. Yeah, so yeah, and the key is it's teamwork. Don't give up hope. There are millions, billions of cases that the medical journals call spontaneous remissions. Y'all might as well have one, right? All right.
We have officially run out of time. However, let us officially close the program and thank Dr. Nieders, please. Thank you very much.
Welcome.